Pleasure Nutritionist Daphne Cohn. Welcome to Sane, Slim, and Gorgeous, your game plan for looking hot, finding calm, and feeling fabulous.
On this call, I am delighted to have with us Rick Hansen. He is an expert in the neuroscience of happiness and love. Rick is going to help us understand why we get stuck in suffering and how we can use our brain to live a life of happiness, love, and wisdom. Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist and a meditation teacher. He is co-founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom and edits the Wise Brain Bulletin. Rick is the author of several books, including Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
So it's great to have you here. And I want to start by asking you, what compelled you to begin to bridge this world of contemplative religion and modern-day neuroscience?
My wife would like to know the answer to that question, too. Well, it gets right at the heart of it, doesn't it? Well, I would say it like this. I've always been very interested in what is it that leads people to happiness, particularly more stable, unshakable happiness and kind of more profound happiness, not the momentary glee you experience at Disneyland. I grew up in Southern California, and I know what that's like. But that which we really long for in our hearts, that is enduring and interwoven with serenity and confidence and strength and reaches out to other people as well and draws us inevitably out into the world in terms of service and a sense of connection with all things, including ultimately the divine. That kind of happiness is what I've always yearned for myself. And when I looked around myself growing up in a pretty ordinary suburban world in Southern California, I didn't see a lot of it out there. So I've always been really interested in how to have that. And then I practiced in many traditions, and along the way I studied psychology and got a PhD and all the rest of that. And also I have a background in business, so I'm thoughtful about how people create happiness in the real world, you know, on the job, at the home, raising kids. My first book was about taking good care of mothers and couples over the long haul and how you could actually do that. So I'm interested in the trenches. And if you want to accomplish something in any kind of a deep way, a smart move is to study the people that are great at it, right?
Right.
If you want to, for example, learn how to cook better, watch these crazy Top Chef shows or something. Or if you play golf, you know, watch a video of some super-duper golf pro and kind of master their stroke. I would do that watching rock climbers. I've done a lot of rock climbing and kind of imagine being in their body. So the people that have really gone the farthest with happiness of the kind that I'm talking about are really concentrated in the contemplative traditions. They're not exclusive to the contemplative traditions, but they're concentrated there. These are the folks who are sometimes described as the Olympic athletes of happiness and mental training. So if you can study what those people are doing and model it and sort out the wheat from the chaff and get to the essences of what they're doing in terms of methods and practices and orientations and relationships and lifestyle and so forth, you can then do that in your own life. Now, most of us in America or the Western world, we're not going to do full-time contemplative practice. We're not going to go to the cave and sit and meditate. And that's where brain science comes in. In the last 20 years, the knowledge about the brain has actually doubled. We know more, twice as much today than we did 20 years ago, wow, about the 3 pounds of tofu between the ears, right? And what happens right there in that tofu, if you will, that marvelous organ that's got over a trillion cells total, over 100 billion neurons total, about 500 trillion connections that are making sense of this conversation right now, lighting up, sparking, communicating to each other, signaling to each other in what has been called an enchanted loom, you know, weaving the tapestry of experience moment to moment to moment. If you could understand increasingly what's going on inside that black box, then, and this is where my book came in, and it's part of what other people are doing as well, other scientists too, is reverse engineering. In other words, if you start to understand the brain states, the state of the brain that correlates with mental states that we care about of enlightenment, even, certainly happiness, love, and wisdom. If you understand the brain states, what's going on in the black box that drives those mental states, then you can actively cultivate, you can actively stimulate and strengthen those brain states that supports the mental states you care about. And that's what it's all about. That's what everybody's always been doing. They just didn't have a good model of what was going on inside the black box. But now with increasing precision and clarity, scientists are telling us, this is where the levers are. These are the buttons you can push. And this is where you, as so many people are in the world today, feeling sort of buffeted, pushed around, kind of out of control, reacting, just doing the best they can, but kind of feeling bounced around by life and their reactions to life. This is where people can increasingly feel they've got control inside themselves. There are things they can do inside themselves that will gradually, just through mental activity alone, transform their brain, which will transform their mind, which will then transform their life. Because if the brain, ultimately, as we'll get into this later, is the cause of our suffering, and it is, alas, you know, the legacy of biological evolution, it can also be the source of its cure. In other words, the brain can also be the source of lasting happiness, love, and wisdom.
This is so exciting. Essentially, what you're saying is that by understanding how the brain works, we have greater access to this idea called happiness.
Absolutely. And I'll give you a little detail. One study that was done on a technology company, so a bunch of hard-boiled, highly stressed, driven type A people, had the scientists come in, and I believe for 8 weeks, they had them all meditate something on the order of 20 minutes a day. And then they compared them to a control group within the same company, so it was apples to apples comparison. And at the end of just 8 weeks, you know, just 2 months and 20 minutes a day, no Tibetan caves, you know, no walking on hot coals, really simple, and no other changes in their life, they found two really interesting physical findings that correlated with the sort of emotional psychological findings. The emotional psychological findings were the people that did 20 minutes a day of a basic mindfulness practice, just tracking your breath and relaxing, essentially, felt a lot better. They felt less stressed. They were easier at home. They were easier to live with. That's really the bottom line. You know if someone's changed by what their family members say about them, right?
Right.
And all that. But what that correlated with physically was, number one, they had greater activation of the left side of the frontal lobes of the brain. So if you imagine, you know, the left side right behind the forehead, that area lit up more in a consistent way at the end of the 8 weeks. And what that is correlated with is greater happiness. In other words, people who have more activation in the left prefrontal cortex have more happiness. And they do so for many reasons, but one is that the left prefrontal cortex acts as the brakes on negative emotions. So if you strengthen the brakes on something you don't want, i.e. negative emotions, then you're going to have more happiness. Also, they had a stronger immune system. Isn't that interesting? Just relaxing, closing your eyes, following your breath 20 minutes a day is going to make your immune system stronger, which is a good thing to have these days, you know, with all these viruses.
Yeah.
But, you know, diseases flying around. The point here, there's a famous saying in neurology, neurons that fire together, wire together. In other words, as people listen to our conversation here or have sensations in their body, look out the window, whatever it is, all of that mental experience is driven by underlying neural activity. It's incredibly fast. It's very complex. But that neural activity is absolutely the basis of mental experience. Quick sidebar, there may well also be something transcendental, you know, an X factor that's in the mix, particularly in terms of conscious experience. But absent that transcendental factor, it's got to be, frankly, the meat. It's got to be the nervous system intertwined with the body altogether, headquartered in the brain, that's producing conscious experience. Now, I personally think there is a transcendental X factor. That said, boy, oh boy, oh boy, there's all kinds of scientific findings that if you change the brain in various ways, you absolutely change conscious experience. I mean, literally just having a cup of coffee changes the brain a little bit. And we've all noticed the results of that, right?
Right.
On the other hand, if you have a head injury or a stroke or a tumor or dementia, that changes the underlying substrate of the brain, the physical material, you know, in the 3 pounds between the ears. And that also changes mental activity. But it's a two-way street. That's what's so great. In other words, as you use the mind is changing the brain as the mind changes, the brain changes, and mental activity sculpts neural structure. In other words, the fleeting immaterial movement of thought over time leaves lasting traces behind inside the brain itself. That's how we learn anything at all. In other words, if we learn, you know, what the capital of New York is, let's say, or, you know, how many things make a dozen, we've actually changed neural structure to have that knowledge deep into us. Most of the knowledge we have, though, is not consciously accessible. It's not information like how many things make a dozen. It's more the experience of living. In other words, are we happy or not? And our experience of living is shaped neurologically by the flow of mental structure. And that gives us, for better or worse, that gives us an incredible power to not casually have negative forces moving through our own minds, because they leave negative traces behind, alas. It's to do things more like you're doing with this wonderful program, to draw people's attention to positive factors and then rest their attention increasingly on those factors and create those positive factors themselves, because you got to earn it. This is not handed to us on a silver platter. We'll talk more about, I'm sure, the tidal currents, if you will, of biological evolution are against quality of life. Basically, there are four gene copies, you know, there are four passing on the genes. They're not for happiness. And so if we're going to be for happiness ourselves, also, I must add, in a world that doesn't seem like it's very for happiness either, with rampant consumerism, crazy media, a busted political system, worldwide stuff, caveman brains armed with nuclear weapons in the 21st century, and all the rest of that, you know, if we're going to be happy, we got to take charge of our brains ourselves. And that's what science is increasingly showing us how to do in terms of specific practices like the meditative ones that I mentioned, and I can give a lot of other examples.
So just to be clear, because we are going to go into why we have this leaning towards negativity and how we can shift out of that, but what is the difference between the brain and the mind? Because that can be very confusing right there.
Yeah, it is actually simple. In other words, it's the distinction between the air itself and the information moving through it carried by sound waves as people listen to this program. Or it's the difference between the physicalness of a piece of paper and the physicalness of the ink on it, distinct from the information carried by the words on the page. In other words, when neurons fire, they signal each other. They send information. For example, they say, that's a red light, that's a green light, that's information. And that flow of information through the nervous system is what is called the mind, broadly defined. That's a way of thinking about mind that isn't complicated by a lot of mystical connotations or sort of murky philosophical confusions. In other words, at the basic level, my cat has mind. In other words, there's a lot of information flowing through my cat's skull. He sees a mouse. There's a lot of information, you know. He sees a dog. There's a lot of different information going through his skull. And that's really all it is. It's kind of like a TV screen. TV screen is physical. It's got a lot of pixels on it. But the words moving across it, let's say, on a news show, or the images moving across it in like a sitcom, are information. So you need the physical substrate to carry the information. The difference between the sound waves and the meaning of words flowing through them, or the TV screen with the information flowing through across it, is that the information flowing across your TV doesn't change it. But that is not how the brain works. The way the brain works is that the information moving through it changes it, for better or worse. Most of those changes are small, subtle, and even temporary, but over time, they become increasingly embedded in neural structure, and they incline the mind increasingly in one direction or another. That's why it's so important to be self-aware about what is in the field of awareness, and also to take steps, like through your program, to learn how to manage it better. That's why my book, Buddha's Brain, was written. Really, it's an operating manual for your own brain, because that's the keys to the kingdom right there. If you can take greater control over what's inside the coconut, as it were, then you have an amazing power to direct your life in a better direction.
This is why, when I was reading the book, I kept jumping up and down, literally, with excitement, because I've lived at a Zen center, I've practiced meditation, but this understanding was like Okay, now I get it. So essentially, the brain is this container that is molded by the information it takes in, which then determines how the mind perceives and reacts to things?
Absolutely. You said it really well. Can I give a couple examples? Am I making it really concrete?
Yeah.
Yeah. One is that a lot of us are pretty stressed these days, and we evolved to handle short-term bursts of stress, like tiger jumping out of bushes, runaway stress. But we did not evolve to handle low-grade chronic stress that's pervasive and pretty inescapable. Multitasking, time pressures, feeling kind of pressed and by other people around one who are also highly stressed, feeling frustrated about not being able to get things done, juggling too many balls in the air, et cetera, getting upset, that's stressful. In other words, just getting upset, getting anxious or irritated, all will jack up the stress system. To balance stress activation, which is carried by a part of the nervous system called the sympathetic nervous system, it really works to activate the brakes on it, which is called the parasympathetic nervous system. These two wings of the nervous system are connected like a seesaw. When one goes up, it pushes the other one down. So if you want to control the impact on your body and your mind and your feelings of chronic stress, it really works to learn about the sympathetic wing of the nervous system and how to, you know, pull its levers and tweak its dials. For example, the parasympathetic nervous system is sometimes called the rest and digest nervous system, distinct from the fight or flight sympathetic nervous system. So rest and digest means that it's very involved in the mouth. And so, for example, touching the lips activates the parasympathetic nervous system. Relaxing the tongue will strengthen the parasympathetic nervous system. Sidebar, remember, as I said, when neurons fire, they wire. So if you stimulate something, you automatically strengthen it. It's like using a muscle, you know what I mean? If you lift a 10-pound weight once, that's good. You'll get a little bit of benefit. If you lift it a lot for a lot of days, you're going to get a lot of benefit. And the same thing goes with building neural structure. Another way to activate the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system is to really do several long exhalations. The parasympathetic handles exhalation, sympathetic handles inhalation. The heartbeat speeds up a little on inhalation, slows down a little on exhalation. So if you deliberately, it's not just take some deep breaths, that's pretty good, but totally focus on the exhalation, like five long, relaxing exhalations. That'll light up your parasympathetic nervous system like a Christmas tree. So you're doing a mental activity, right? You're thinking about something, and then you're engaging your body in doing it. And that right there will start building more neural structure over, that'll help you over time. In other words, you'll start building up a more of an automatic protective response to stressors coming at you. And in the moment, you'll feel better. I'll give you a second example with purely mental activity alone. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we were talking, I think you said, you alluded to the negativity bias, I think. And scientists have really been understanding better how it is that biological evolution shapes our daily experience of living. And so one of the ways that it does that is that, on the one hand, we evolved when we're not threatened. In other words, under threat level green, as it were. In other words, when we're not hungry, we're not in pain, we're not being, nothing bad is just lurking around the corner, and we're not on the receiving end of, you know, mistreatment by people around us, because remember, we evolved in social bands over 80 million years of primate evolution. I mean, we evolved in groups of others like us. So how others affect us and treat us is really has been important in evolution, because that's been an important part of being able to survive and, you know, have children who survive themselves. So over that long run, on the one hand, when it's threat level green, we're really mellow people. We are innately, I call it the three C's. We are calm, contented, and caring. That's our home base. The problem is, to survive in very, very harsh and lethal conditions with a very, very high death rate over the millions of years of evolution, we are rapidly and immediately driven from home at the crack of a twig, an angry scowl in another member of our group, or the cough of a leopard in the bushes nearby, right? And as soon as that happens, boom, we're in threat level orange, if not red. And the brain evolved to make the mistake 99 times of thinking there was a leopard in the bushes when there really wasn't, to avoid making the one mistake in 100 when there actually was a leopard and you missed it. So if you think about it, carrots and sticks, it's important to get carrots in life, right? The goodies, the rewards, and it's also important to avoid the sticks. So we evolved these various systems to help us do that. The problem is that if you miss a carrot today, you'll probably have another crack at one tomorrow. But if you miss a stick today, whap! You know what I mean? You miss a predator, you miss a hazard, or especially you miss social aggression in your group, your band, your tribe. Bam! You probably won't have a chance at any more sticks for the rest of your life. Pardon me, you won't have a chance at any more carrots for the rest of your life. So the brain evolved this negativity bias that preferentially looks for threats. There are parts of the brain that are just hardwired to constantly scan for threats. We tend to feel this ongoing trickle of anxiety at a minimum. Some of us feel a lot more than a trickle. It's more like a stream or a flood that leads us to continually scan the world for threats. And then when we track something, when we get bad news, as it were, the brain immediately reacts to it, stores it in high-priority storage, and then if anything comes along down the road, you know, a year later, 30 years later, that's remotely similar to that, you know, threatening piece of information, boom, it's immediately fast-tracked for retrieval. That's negativity bias. The bottom line is that even though most of our experiences are neutral to positive, the brain looks for and remembers and stores the 1 in 100 that's negative. That's why at the end of a good day, what do we think about? It's the one thing that went wrong, right? Or the one thing that we're worried about tomorrow. In effect, the brain is like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. That's the negativity bias. And so to correct it, to level the playing field, we've got to be radically tilted toward our own well-being, which, of course, is intertwined with promoting the welfare of others. So one way to do that, that I talk about in the fourth chapter of the book, Taking in the Good, is to half a dozen times a day, like even right now, identify a positive fact and let it become a positive experience. That's just step one. That's easy. Step two, stay with it. Don't just move on in 3 to 5 seconds, which is what people commonly do, or frankly, push it away, which we often do. Someone compliments us, so we push it away. We notice we finish something. We just go, huh, I should have done more already. Or we notice some good quality in ourselves, and we go, huh, but if you only knew about the rest of me, you know, like that. Instead of doing that, let that positive fact become a positive experience, step one. And step two, stay with it for 20, 30 seconds if you can. That will really get those neurons firing together. And especially if you can feel it kind of in your whole body as much as possible, this positive experience. It's not a positive idea. It's a positive feeling and sensations you're going after here, because that's how you really build emotional memory. And then third step, sense and intend that it's really sinking into you and weaving into the fabric of your brain and therefore the fabric of yourself. So you have it as a resource you can draw on increasingly in the future. That act of attention alone, in other words, it's entirely mental. You could be in a business meeting. You could be just kind of observing your kids. You could be marking time, you know, in traffic. Nobody knows you're doing it. But while you're doing it, maybe with a little half smile on your face, you're actually weaving neural structures together that will make you more resilient, confident, that will lift mood, that will gradually heal over time, painful life experiences, and will naturally incline you toward becoming more loving and caring toward other people, because happy people are caring people. There are a lot of unhappy people who are caring as well, but happiness increases pro-social behavior. So it's a fancy way of saying that, you know, aren't you nicer when you're happier,
yeah,
right, than when you're unhappy or irritated or just feeling overwhelmed, right, because then we have more to give other people. But that's an example right there of how you can use your mind alone to change your brain, to change your mind, to change your life.
So there's two things here, because one of them is just to really reiterate this point of the negativity bias, because it can help people foster more compassion for themselves when we understand that we actually are going against our evolutionary instinct. That's the first thing. And the second one is, it sounds like this is what you mean when you say our brain learns mainly from what we attend to.
That's right. You know, attention, I think of it as a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. It lights up what it rests upon and sucks it into the brain. Lots of other information is coming into us outside the field of conscious awareness. little detail here. For example, they can do experiments where they'll flash a picture of a face for about 0.2 seconds, and so it's too fast to actually consciously see the face. And then they'll play a neurological trick where they'll mask the face, so you literally, you can't see it consciously. It cannot go into conscious memory. But people will still react to the facial expression, for example, whether the facial expression is angry or smiling, right? So information does flow into the brain outside the field of conscious awareness, but it's like a 5-lane superhighway coming in through conscious awareness. That's why what we rest our attention upon and keep our attention upon is really important, because that's a way that we can have a lot of self-directed brain change. In other words, by putting our attention on things that are the good news in our world. I don't mean any kind of Pollyanna, ostrich in the, you know, head in the sand kind of deal here. I mean, there are threats out there. There are difficulties we need to address and manage and so forth. But when I look out at the world, I don't see any shortage of recognition of threats. You know what I mean? I don't see any shortage of obsession with bad news. I mean, that's what the media is about. That's what people talk about. As they say in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads, because that's what people pay attention to. Interestingly, I think one of the really important things for people to pay attention to is their own natural goodness. We don't do that. Most of the time, we're focused on our flaws or our deficits or the things we've done wrong. But each one of us has an enormous well of natural goodness, natural sincerity, natural inclination toward the good in other people. We may be driven sometimes from that home base, or as they say in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, it may be that true nature may be obscured momentarily by greed, hatred, or delusion, broadly defined. But the truth is, it's always there. It's our true nature. And a growing felt sense of that and appreciation of it, and a growing given overness, if you will, to that as the current, the wellspring of what moves us forward through our days, is something we can all do, and we can all cultivate the capacity to do it. That's why, in part, I think it's really important to train attention. It's interesting that William James, the father of American psychology, in the late 1800s, was writing about this, and he said the education of attention would be an education par excellence. In other words, would be the highest education of all. And that's because attention is the spotlight vacuum cleaner. Where we rest it goes right into our brain. And most of us have very skittery attention, partly as the result of evolution that made us want to be kind of anxious, irritable scanners. Because anxious, irritable threat scanners picked up the cough of a leopard nearby, and people who are all blissed out and zen-like and tuned in to their innermost being, you know, they got the chop. We're the great-great-great-grandchildren of very nervous and cranky forebears, and we carry those tendencies within us, but we don't have to be overcome by them. That's where conscious self-education and conscious mental training come in. And then we have the culture, and we have the kids these days. Like my kids, for example, are bored watching a movie made in the 80s because there aren't frequent enough cuts. Mm-hmm. But my 91-year-old dad, who's still sharp as a tack, can't watch TV these days because it's too abrasive. In other words, too much happens too fast. It's like he can't follow it. It's too intense. So what's happened is that we've habituated a whole generation to an incredibly intense incoming stream of data and change and information flow. And as a result, anything less than that feels flat. It's like, you know, if you give a little kid a candy bar, apples don't taste sweet anymore because the candy bar kind of swamps the sweetness in the apple. So for all those reasons, that's why I think there's been such an interest in mindfulness these days and the contemplative traditions as well, because they involve training of attention. And that's why I actually devote 2 chapters in the book to various aspects of training attention, both for everyday life so we can concentrate better and not be so distracted, and we can also steady the mind more so we can shine the spotlight on our own inner workings to understand them better so we can nudge them gently over time in a positive direction, but also so that for those people that are interested in any kind of directed personal growth practice, whether it's therapy or yoga or Tai Chi or martial arts or meditation or prayer, you know, very broadly defined, being able to steady the mind is critically important for success in those endeavors. And I did 1 chapter entirely about how to steady the mind for absorption, in deep states of awareness and use a roadmap of the Buddha about what the stepping stones are in terms of mental states that lead to deep absorption. Then I figured out plausibly what the underlying neural conditions are that promote each one of those mental states that are the stepping stones to absorption, and then broke down things people can do with their minds alone to stimulate and strengthen those neural states underneath each one of those mental states that are the stepping stones to absorption.
Yeah, it's an incredible amount of information in Buddha's brain, and we will, on the second call, go into some more practical applications. I want to ask you, Rick, what if a person has experienced tremendous suffering in their life? Is it still possible to retrain the brain to focus on what will bring us joy, love, and peace?
It really absolutely is. It may take more work, but it absolutely is. The fancy term is neuroplasticity. Plasticity simply means being flexible or bendable. You know, like a piece of rubber is bendable, let's say. It's plastic in that sense. And literally, people who've damaged major regions of the brain can recover function, in many cases, by training other parts of the brain to take over. And if they can do that, if they've been through a catastrophic auto accident, that indicates some of the possibilities for people recovering from trauma, child abuse, major chemical addiction issues, things of that sort. It's not an easy road. Let's be real about it. And if I could say a few words about that, I think one thing that's really important is to build up capacities around the trauma. And I'll just talk about trauma here as kind of an example, or the wound, if you will. First of all, build up capacities around the wound. Don't tackle the wound too soon. A lot of people make the mistake of jumping into the wound too fast, and then they get overwhelmed, they get sucked back down into it, because the brain is basically a giant network of associations. So if you link to something that's very powerful, it just sucks you kind of right into it. So build up resources, for example, of self-compassion, which is absolutely critical for healing. And in the book, I talk about different things you can do neurologically that are clever to build up self-compassion, which is actually hard for a lot of people, to wish themselves well, to wish that they not suffer, which is the essence of compassion. In other words, tender concern and goodwill. In Buddhism, it's said that the essential meaning of kindness is the wish that others be happy, and the essence of compassion is the wish that they not suffer. And one can apply, of course, kindness and compassion toward oneself as well. And all the contemplative traditions I know about, and certainly in Buddhism, that's considered to be really, really foundational. As Pema Chodron puts it, she says, the root of Buddhism is compassion, and the root of compassion is compassion for oneself. So I'm not here to push Buddhism. I'm just using it as an example. But right there, an absolutely major teacher, as a nun in the Tibetan tradition, as you know, is promoting self-compassion. And in addition to self-compassion, I think there's a key around getting on one's own side, which, again, is tough to do because it's sad but true that as mammals, we're very vulnerable to what's called learned helplessness. In other words, you can train a dog whose emotional circuitry is very much like a human to be completely helpless and passive and depressed with about 5 trials of being exposed to uncontrollable and painful, not catastrophic, but painful electric shock, whereas other dogs exposed to the same amount of electric shock but who have control over ending it, all right, don't become helpless or depressed. And then it takes, you know, dozens and dozens, sometimes over 100 trials to help that dog unlearn the helplessness that he or she acquired. So, and we're like that. So it's when a person has had a tough life, including, you know, milder versions of trauma, like just getting laid off or, you know, having your life savings just blown up because the pension fund of your corporation just, you know, went away somehow in some Wall Street shell game. It's easy to feel pushed around by life because we are pushed around by life. That's why it's very important, I think, to, as part of mental attitude and training, to focus on where we do have efficacy. In other words, where we are a hammer and not a nail, where we are the cue ball, not the eight ball, and thereby help protect ourselves in part from the effects of helplessness, and then over time build up more sense of confidence going forward. The third and last thing I'll say in passing here about building up resources neurologically. And by the way, that I should add, that felt sense of being for yourself, it's very important to activate it in a visceral way because, you know, the brain is very intertwined with the body. And one of the really interesting scientific initiatives these days is in what's called embodied cognition, the idea that what seems like pure thought is actually very intertwined with body sensations, postures, and all the rest. So, for example, if a person wants to feel more for themselves and more sort of confident or strong going forward, sit up straighter. Put your shoulders back a little. Lift up your chest. Lift up your chin. Look out at the world in a very direct way. You know, like an actor would. Just that physical motion will send signals internally to your brain that to become alert and strong and grounded and confident in the world. So the third thing is really important, especially if you've had a hard life or are currently having a hard life, is to work the third major motivational system in the brain, which is the affiliation system, the attachment, love, relationship, belonging system. And that's the part that has to do with feeling included, liked, respected, cherished, and loved. And it's interesting that, as I said earlier, carrots and sticks, you know, we evolved to pursue carrots and to avoid sticks. There are two fundamental systems in the brain that do that. Interestingly, as you know, in Buddhism, there's what's called the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. In psychology, it's called the hedonic tone. In other words, all experience has this quality of it's either pleasurable or unpleasant or just kind of neutral. And that signaling evolved to help us understand, you know, approach the pleasant, avoid the unpleasant. Well, crocodiles and sharks have that system, but birds and mammals, and especially primates and radically especially humans, have a third critical system, which is the system of love or attachment. And that system is what soothes the baby who's been frightened by a leopard next, you know, in a bushes nearby. And it's what helps calm the body when someone who's about to have a painful operation holds the hand of a loved one, or someone who's a subject in an experiment about to get a mildly painful electric shock who's in an MRI and holding the hand of a loved one and having a lot less reaction to the pain simply through the touch of the loved one. That system's critically important, and it's really fabulous. There's a growing amount of scientific understanding of things like neurohormones and transmitters like oxytocin and vasopressin that are involved in that system, the importance of early life experiences and how they shape that system, and interestingly, how even if there were deficits in that attachment affiliation system growing up, in terms of, for example, getting empathic attunement from one's caregivers, by giving oneself today empathic attunement through mindfulness practices or self-awareness practices where people tune into themselves, by doing that today, we start shoring up those deficits and shortages that were present in our environment growing up. Because deep down in the brain, it doesn't know what the source is of neurons firing together. And if they're firing because we are tuning into ourselves, they're still going to wire together, just like they did or would have done when we were little kids. So those three things right off the top I would think of for dealing with difficulty, you know, self-compassion, getting on your own side, being for yourself. That doesn't mean being against others, but being for yourself. And third, affiliation, both connecting with others, looking for a support system, reaching out, opening up to support, not being that tough, individualistic, classic American, you know, with a six-gun in one holster and a bag of gold in the other, you know, making his way, usually a man, his way through life alone. No, reaching out and connecting with other people, but also connecting with yourself. And that then is going to shore up the capacities that will then enable a person to go after the deep wound itself. And that's actually, I should add, in the book I talk about the fourth step of taking in the good. That is where you can use positive experiences today and gradually heal old painful ones. And I describe the way memory mechanisms work so that you can, in effect, trick the brain to gradually replace the painful feelings, including unconscious ones, related to difficult experiences in life. You can gradually replace those with positive emotions. You won't forget that the episode occurred. You know what I mean? You won't forget that you were hit by a drunk driver when you were 12, or that your stepfather was really, really awful to you, or whatever it is, or you were in combat and a terrible thing happened. You won't forget the event, but the charge on the event and the associated problematic emotions and attitudes can gradually be replaced in positive ways, and which literally are woven into the fabric of the brain.
So creating healing for ourselves by developing compassion for ourselves, getting on our side, our own side, and connecting with others is really going against, again, our natural instinct.
Yes. Yeah. Although we have instincts towards self-compassion and kindness, and we have instincts toward being for ourselves, certainly, it's just that those capacities, if you will, are trumped. They're overruled or overwhelmed by strategies we also acquired over evolution to react to threats. And the thing to understand is that the brain was not designed in toto perfectly. It wasn't like some great architect said, I'm going to design a fantastic brain, and it's going to be complete, you know, it's perfect. No, the brain was cobbled together over 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system. It has layers in it. It's kind of, you know, fact, three major layers, the reptile, early primate, and modern human brains, all sit on top of each other like three scoops on an ice cream cone. And they all interact, and those lower levels, the sort of reptilian or early mammalian brain, is very automatic, very fast, and very intense. And when it gets in the mix, it tends to overwhelm the slower but more powerful prefrontal or cortical regions of the brain. You know, the word cortex comes from the word bark. It means the outer shell. So that outer shell got added, you know, fairly recently. And even though it's very, very powerful, it's kind of slow. That's why doing practices that gradually strengthen those kind of higher level capacities and attitudes and skills is really important, because honestly, you know the old joke, I'm sleeping with the enemy, right?
Yeah.
Well, we all sleep with the enemy in some sense of the word, inside our own head.
Right.
In other words, that crocodile brain, that little monkey mind, it's fully loaded and operational, and it's murmuring in the shadows. You know, I love the Lord of the Rings books, and I love the movies too, of course. And Wormtongue, you know, Wormtongue, that character in the movie or the books, who is whispering kind of evil messages and self defeating and helplessness promoting and inadequacy promoting and depressing messages to King Theoden. Well, Wormtongue's alive right between the ears. And we need to talk back to Wormtongue in an active way. Otherwise, that creepy guy is going to be sending us down the wrong side of the river.
One thing that really stuck out for me is I want to know, like, how we even navigate in the world. Because you write in Buddha's Brain, your brain simulates the world. Each of us lives in a virtual reality that's close enough to the real thing that we don't bump into the furniture.
Well, yeah, we do live in the simulator, and one of the takeaways from that for me is, wow, I've gotten a lot more careful about what I let myself just sort of ruminate about. You know, most of us, we have these little mini-movies running all the time. Often they're quite short, where we imagine ourselves in different situations, or we kind of are reflecting on little things. And it's interesting to consider, what kind of mini-movie is it? You know what I mean? Is it The Sound of Music, or is it Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? Are the themes in those mini-movies, you know, accurate to reality, all of reality, or are they focused on some small aspects of our environment or our relationships or ourselves, and then just kind of running 24/7? Because when neurons fire together, they wire together in the simulator as well. When those movies are running, those neurons are firing, and they're wiring along. And so I've tried to become more mindfully aware, and that's where self-awareness practices really come in and are so helpful. I've tried to become more mindfully aware of what kind of movies are running, you know? What's going on there? And increasingly take action. That's very, very important. You know, we're not talking here about, you know, like I said, rose-colored glasses, head in the sand. It's to take action toward the problems out there, or inside our own head, or what we do need to correct in our own character, you know, gradually over time, in a way that's self-compassionate, not harsh and shaming. But after we take appropriate action, move on, change the channel. You know what I mean? Soken Rinpoche, a great Tibetan teacher, says, "Think the same thought, okay, but 10 is enough." 10 is enough. After you've run that same mini movie where you're angrily quarreling in your mind with your partner or your boss or your parent or your teenager, and it's not going anywhere, after you've run that show 10 times, I think that's enough, and it's time for a different station.
Yeah, 10 can often even be too much for some of us.
I agree. I like 2, you know, for me. 1 or 2, that's enough. But I think the great takeaway here is that over time, in a way that's based in science and earned, people have the power to skillfully use their mind to change their brain, to change their mind, to change their life. And that's an amazing thing. That's just fantastic. I get taken to gratitude when I think about the extraordinary gift that was given to me. I don't want to get too graphic here. You know, when I was conceived, right? When those little DNA strands came together, bam, on the moment of my conception, or anyone's conception, we were all handed an extraordinary gift. We were just handed the build-out instructions for the human brain, which is then embedded in relationships with other people, which then changes the brain over time in the right way. We were just given that. We didn't earn it. No one could possibly earn that incredible gift, which enables us to listen to programs like this, you know, make pancakes, go for a walk if we can, love each other, enjoy life. I myself am just fascinated by outer space. I just think it's extraordinary what we're learning about the universe these days, and also learning about human beings. You know, we were given those capacities. So to me, I go right to gratitude. What an extraordinary gift. Plop. Landed in the lap. Wow. Wonderful. But it also goes to responsibility. Because now that we've got this fantastic gift, how shall we use it? Shall we use it to indulge our own negative thinking, anxious preoccupations that we just run over and over and over, digging deeper grooves in our own brain? Will we use these wonderful capacities to develop ever more skillful ways to exploit them while protecting us, or ever more skillful ways to blow them up while protecting us? Will we use it for that? Or alternately, will we use it for developing capacities inside ourselves that make ourselves better people every day, that make ourselves more skillful and strong in the world and capable of managing our own reactions and also working skillfully with other people? And also, will we act in a way that helps us see the world much more clearly and we realize that we're not so threatened, actually, by so many things that we feel threatened by on the world stage, that the truth is that we do not live in a threat-level orange world. On any given day, the probability of a bad thing happening at this airport, on this day, on my flight, is vanishingly small. It's threat-level green on that particular day. Right? And yet we live in a time when we tend to think that the whole world, you know, is about to blow up, and it's not. There are things we ought to deal with. Global warming in particular, I think, is an incredibly important thing to deal with. You know, the timetable of global warming is unclear, but no one doubts that if you keep dumping carbon into the atmosphere, you will create a greenhouse. It's only a question of time, right, and how awful it is before you, you know, shift and go into a different direction. In other words, will we take steps along those lines? As I talk in the book, in everyone's heart is a wolf of love and a wolf of hate. Will we nourish and strengthen and let loose the wolf of love? Will we restrict and put the wolf of hate, you know, on a super-duper juice fast, right? Or will we just indulge the kind of standard tendencies of the caveman brain, which is to fear them and grab everything we possibly can as fast as we can, you know, anxious and cranky the whole way? And that's the choice before us in the 21st century, and that's one thing that really drove me to write the book. I just feel that we are at a critical time in the history of the planet. We're on the edge of the sword, and it could go either way. It could go really great. We really could veer away from the cliff, but we are headed for a cliff, certainly for the poorest 1, 2, 3 billion people on the planet, you know, half the planet especially, is really headed for the cliff, and life is looking pretty bumpy and miserable for a large fraction of the other half of the planet as well. And I think a critical aspect of steering away from that cliff is for a critical mass of people in this world to get more skillful with their own brains, to get more skillful with these, you know, reptile monkey mind tendencies, and take more control of them in skillful ways and direct the world, therefore, in a better way.
It's a great way to wrap up, because as we make this choice between the wolf of love and the wolf of hate, it's so valuable to hold what you just shared, this image of what a gift it is that we are even here now. And then where do we want to go? But really seeing our life as a gift and making our choices from that place.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. It was wonderful, and I look forward to the next call when we go more in-depth with the practical applications. So thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. If people want a lot of tons of free resources, they can get to me through buddhasbrain.com. I offer a lot on that website, scientific papers, talks I've given, things people can read, slide sets from my workshops. There's a lot there at buddhasbrain.com.
Wonderful. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.